And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Laurie Houston. And this is the second portion of the show where I get to speak with an author. And tonight's author is Gershon Winkler, who has written a book called Daily Kabbalah, Wisdom from Tree of Life. And I know a tiny bit about Kabbalah through some of my teachings, and I found this book very interesting. So welcome, Gershon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, we're happy to talk about all sorts of things on Intuitive Soul, and I think, you know, this should be a very interesting talk. So, you know, why don't you talk a little bit about your journey and how you got to where you are now?
My journey.
Mm.
Wow. That would take a lot of intuiting. Well, I arrived in this world, I think, at the age of 4, because I don't remember anything before that.
Wow.
And I just kind of grew up in Denmark, in Copenhagen.
Nice.
And till about age 8 or so, and then we came to the United States, grew up a little bit in New York, in an Orthodox Jewish family. Really beautiful, wonderful childhood. A lot of playfulness, a lot of lightness of being. And educated very much in the ultra-Orthodox way, and which marinated me in the texts, in the source texts of Aramaic and Hebrew, all the way through my adolescence into my adulthood. I was finally studied in Jerusalem for several years and was ordained there by a great master who was also a great mystic, and with whom me and about 7 other young men, in their late teens, would gather every Wednesday night and study personally with him from the Kabbalah. So that was my first introduction to Jewish mysticism. It was through him, Rabbi Eliezer Ben Sion, a very old sage who's long gone. And then I came back to the States and was in the Army for a while during the draft, back in the Vietnam War, and then back in New York again, grew up, lived a nice life, married with children and all that stuff, began to teach basic Jewish stuff to people who were interested. And about when I reached about 32, age 32, I began to feel that the pangs of new birthing happening inside of me, probably seeded by that the Kabbalah that I had studied in Israel but had kind of let go of, just kind of seen it as nice theory and theoretical and nice ideology. So the seed began to sprout inside me and grow a nice big tree and threw me clear out of the party line mainstream Orthodox way of life into more of the esoteric. And I left New York and went to live in the wilderness for about 25, 26 years.
Wow.
I lived in the wilderness of West Virginia, the wilderness of Colorado, 11 years in New Mexico, and just kind of felt that there's so much about my people's tradition that got lost in being forced into urban life for some 1,500 years, not being allowed to be on the land and stuff like that. And I was something inside of me was very hungry for going back to that kind of Aboriginal Jewish spirituality, as I call it. And so I began to realize from meeting a lot of other fellow Jewish women and men that they too were looking for something beyond what was being fed to them in synagogues and temples. And a lot of my fellow Jews were running to Native Americans and to Aboriginal shamans in New Guinea and Peru. And so I began to feel, you know what, I wish I could share with them that what they're looking for in those other traditions, we have as well in our tradition. And so I began to teach that and bring out the sources that I had been introduced to many years ago in Israel. And it began to click with me. Living in the wilderness, all the theoretical Kabbalah I had studied began to come alive for me and began to be more than just theory that we carried with us into our long exile. So I wrote a book called Magic of the Ordinary, Recovering the Shamanic in Judaism, and that drew interest in people and having retreats and workshops, which I've been leading, and together with my beloved Miriam Maron, who is a shamanic healer and practitioner in the Jewish faith as well. Yes. And then I wrote this book, The Daily Kabbalah, or Kabbalah 365, as it was called in its first printing, then it went out of print. Now it's reprinted, called Daily Kabbalah, where I translated into English many for the first time from original non-popular, that means like lesser promulgated, as I call it, teachings from the Kabbalah that most people are not aware of, that have a lot to do with earth, with the four directions, with animal spirits, you know, subjects that most Jewish people, let alone people who are not of our faith, have no clue that Judaism has a rich tradition about. The song of the stars, the spirit of birds, and the song, the language of frogs, so many different kind of mystical traditions in the Kabbalah that are not really in the English language translations that you find in popular Kabbalah books. And so I wrote this book, and the people are really enjoying it, and I'm really glad to hear that. And I'm enjoying it, too. I just got to read it lately myself. And that's basically what I enjoy doing for many years now, is re-examining and reading lesser-known traditions of Jewish mysticism that date way back 2, 3, sometimes 4,000 years, much of it not translated yet into any language other than the original Hebrew and Aramaic, and a lot of it being recovered only of late from old manuscripts that had been preserved by those who censored it back in the early Middle Ages.
Yes.
And so, you know, namely the church and Europe, and so a lot of it is in under glass in the Library of Moscow, Paris, Oxford, and Hebrew University in Israel has been collecting all these gems and putting it back into print, but in Hebrew, thanks to Professor Moshe Idel and his teacher, Gershom Shalem, the late Gershom Shalem. So little by little, a lot of the lesser-known, lesser-taught Kabbalah, which I feel is more of interest to us today, Jewish or not, is becoming more available. And I like translating it and teaching it and sharing with people, because it really blows their minds and expands their knowledge and makes life a lot more fun.
You know, that is the biggest thing that I found about this, is, and I was going to ask you a lot about this, because, you know, in anything that I have come across, I mean, this is the first time that, you know, the shamanic type studies came in involved with Kabbalah. And I've, you know, like I said, I haven't done a lot of research in Kabbalah. I know some, you know, very basics, but I found it really fascinating. And I found, you know, that's the big thing about religion these days, is that often, you know, it does go so far back. I mean, it would be impossible not to have some roots in the earth and some roots in understanding everything, not just, you know, where we are right now. And I also had heard that, you know, Kabbalah never used to be taught until you were married and you were in your 40s and you were male. Now,
well, the male part doesn't exist anywhere. That's hearsay.
Okay.
The other part, it does say, because there were many, many women Kabbalists, teachers back in the ancient times.
Great.
And part of the early Middle Ages, and then it stopped for a while because of what was happening to Christian women of wisdom who were being burnt at the stake. So our women had to go underground with their big wisdom knowledge.
Yeah, good enough reason.
Yeah. There's a great book by Professor Llewellyn Barstow. She's a professor at Westbury University in New York, who wrote a book called Witch Craze, where she talks about how both the women and Jews as a group were persecuted for their mystical dabbling, And a lot of it went underground, both by women and both by the Jewish people. But the shamanic elements are very much there, and by all means also had to go underground a little bit. You know, it's just now, even now, Native Americans are just coming out of the woodwork with some of their dances that were forbidden in this country until the 1970s. Like the ghost dance and other such dances. And the Wiccans are coming out of the woodwork, too, because it's illegal to burn people at the stake in this country.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. Right. So, but the thing about not, you know, you have to be 40, and, I mean, what if you die at 28 and miss out on the whole thing? They have to reincarnate your ass back here and start all over again. You know, so that stuff is very latter-day teaching in the Jewish codes of law, due to an incident that happened in the 1600s of a guy who took Kabbalah to the extreme and misled a lot of tens of thousands of Jews to thinking he was the Messiah. His name was Shabtai Tzvi, and he raised their hope, and in the end he was forced to convert to Islam by the Sultan of Turkey.
Wow.
But because of what happened and how easy it is for a charismatic teacher to take Kabbalah to the extremes and mislead a lot of people with it, the rabbis began to say, no, you got to be like at least 40. That means like you have to be very learned, because 40 is symbolic in Jewish tradition of understanding. It was a symbolic age. 40 means understanding, 50 means wisdom, and so on and so forth. And so, and you had to be married with children, because that would keep you grounded.
Mm.
You know, like people think I sit and study Kabbalah with a little candle in a nice, quiet little cabin. But, you know, every 5 minutes, Dad, yes, Dad, yes, Dad, yes, Dad, yes. Right? That keeps me grounded. Dad, yes, one more. You know, so... It does keep one grounded while one is moving into the esoteric, but it really isn't an absolute kind of requirement. You know, it's just something that came about because of a particular incident in the 1600s. Before that, there was no such thing. People studied Kabbalah with teachers who would accept them or not accept them based on their on whether they had a foundation or not. These days, today, you know, there are many people who have no background in basic Judaism, and people are criticizing me and others for teaching them Kabbalah, but I feel that we can't judge someone who's yearning to study the mystical aspects of whatever tradition. It might be that their soul has come back just for that. Because in a previous lifetime, they were too much in their head or too much in the intellect and cognitive parts, and they're yearning for the mystical. And to deny that to people, I think, is a worse kind of situation.
That's lovely. I think, you know, I think there's no reason to deny anybody any knowledge or any wisdom, regardless of what it is or where they're coming from or why they're wanting it. I think,
yes, totally agree.
We can misuse it, but in this case, it's all quite beautiful, and there's nothing that anybody, I can't imagine that anybody could misuse in this case.
Yeah, I that's why the selections I chose for these books are not from our books on sorcery and stuff.
You know, right.
There's a lot of whole aspect of Kabbalah that has to do with, it's called Kabbalah Masiyot, which means active Kabbalah, which is about sorcery and magic. And, you know, I don't teach that kind of stuff because, you know, you don't know who you're teaching it to.
Right.
And whether they might misuse it or not. But all these other teachings are so fascinating and so mind-expanding and helps people to look, to open up their eyes beyond the way in which they've been accustomed to seeing things. And that's what basically Kabbalah is about. The word Kabbalah is Hebrew for receiving, being open to receive the experience, to, you know, just like your show is called, it has the word intuit in it. It's about intuiting. It's about expanding that gift that each of us has that intuits more of life around us than meets the eye.
You took one of my big thoughts. I was gonna talk right. about receiving. So, you know, Kabbalah is about the tree of life and the wisdoms that we can get from that. And again, you have a lot of shamanism within it, which I guess I don't know necessarily what the term shamanism would mean in this regards, but it certainly is about the mystical traditions. And what would you see as the big difference between the religion and, say, Kabbalah or the Tree of Life or the mysticism of the religion?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Kabbalah, I can't speak for the mysticism of other traditions, but right. the Kabbalah itself grew out of the basic tradition of Judaism. And what it grew out of in that tradition is the most prominent part of the tradition, which is the oral tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are not aware that Judaism is primarily an oral tradition. And we have one written tradition, which is the Torah, which is a basic guide, but its interpretation and translation is ever, ever evolving. So the words never change, the letters never change, mm-hmm. but there are no vowels, which leaves one to be able to read it and understand it only through the accompanying oral tradition. Right. And the idea of the oral tradition is to enable the written word to remain fluid. Mm-hmm. And so since it is fluid, the ancient sage would look at a word in that Torah, in that ancient spiritual guide, and they would see more than just what the word means. And so Kabbalah kind of evolved out of opening up one's eyes to see beyond the way in which one has been accustomed to seeing. There's a teaching in the Talmud, for example, which is a collection of oral traditions several thousand years ago, that says one who translates the Torah literally is a falsifier. Hmm. You were not supposed to be translating it literally. You were supposed to be looking into it and see beyond the words. The words are there as symbols to direct us to what is beyond it. And it's like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who lived in the second century in the Galilee, he said, one who looks at the Torah, you know, the Genesis, Exodus, all those stories and teachings, literally, it is as if one says to another person, "Wow, you are a beautiful coat," not realizing or acknowledging that there's a body behind the coat and a soul behind the body. Mm. So the connection of Kabbalah to the so-called religion of Judaism or tradition of Judaism is very intimate. It's just that what happens is that people under duress or other circumstances prevents them from going deeper into the practice, and so the practice becomes rote, and the knowledge becomes rote, and the deeper meaning behind things ceases. It's just like my teacher back in Jerusalem. He used to say, once an ideology becomes a movement, it ceases to move. It stops moving. And that's what happens to religion. It begins with an ideology, it begins with an idea, with a concept, it begins with an oral tradition. But then people, you know, get lazy, and rather than continuously playing with it and dancing with the tradition and evolving it and spiraling it into the human experience, which is ever fluid, we just get lazy and say, well, this is how you do it, and you have to do it this way, and do it that way, and the other way. Otherwise, you're not a good Jew or a good Muslim or a good Christian or a good Hindu, right? We just lose sight of the fluidity of these traditions. It becomes something completely antithetical to the people who gave birth to it thousands of years ago. So Kabbalah mysticism is very much about the tradition that gave birth to it, which has become a religion. But it's a branch, and it's based on the traditional Hebrew scripture, which talks about the tree of life. And the tree of life is actually tree of many lives, not just tree of life, because there's no word in Hebrew for life. There's only a word for Hebrew for living and for lives, plural. Chaim means lives. It's a plural word. Many people don't realize that. So it's an ever-branching tree of knowledge and wisdom and understanding and perception and experience that has no end. It's infinite. The branches continue to branch. The twigs continue to extend, and the leaves continue to grow, and the fruits continue to evolve, and the and blossom, and the seeds fall in the earth and grow another tree. So it's like an eternal unfolding of creation, and that's what it represents, an eternal, infinite unfolding of creation within what we call nature and within each of us, our lives. Every moment we have as many choices of roads and paths to take as there are stars in the heavens, as there are galaxies. You know, the choices are so endless, and that's what the Tree of Lives represents. Very few of us live one life in a lifetime.
That's true, too.
Every 10 years or so, we change our mind.
Yeah.
And we move somewhere else, or we do something different.
Yeah.
Or we find new friends, or we read new books, or we're not interested in that book anymore. We're interested in this other book, or we join a different religion, or we go to a different seminar. Or we write letters to the editor criticizing them for publishing an article that we wrote 15 years ago. It's endless. The tree of lives, many lives. And it's interesting that you find the tree of life concept not just in Judaism.
Yeah.
I was surprised to find it in the Lakota tradition and in Australia, in the Aboriginal tradition. A lot of ancient traditions have this concept. And it's like you said earlier, Laurie, that the farther back you go, probably the more we have in common in terms of how a human being experiences the elementals of being here, of existence,
right,
of life, of nature, of all that surrounds us, all that we are.
That's beautiful. I remember in one of my teachings that the tree of life is, you know, obviously the grounding in the earth and how we are here on earth. And it is the teachings to move us up to our enlightenment or our, you know, to reach the heavens so that we can partake in that information. And that at the same time, that information was brought down and of the mysticism or that the mystic part of each religion or culture is, you know, the teachings that God gave us to understand life more and to, not that it was ever meant to be hidden, but again, you spoke of a very important time in history where women were being killed and burnt for knowing about the earth because they believed that the earth magic, the Wiccan tradition, that meant that they were witches and evil. And so obviously that stuff would be hidden, but you know that knowledge has always been there.
And that's what the tree represents. You see, that the reason why, one of the many reasons why the tree was chosen to represent that wisdom, that the wisdom of the kiss of sky and earth, of heaven and earth, is because tree is that. Tree is rooted below and drawn from above. You know, it is drawn upward toward the heavens beyond the earth by virtue of it being rooted deeper and deeper within the earth. The deeper a tree grows its roots into the earth, the higher toward the heavens it grows. And that's a very fundamental principle in Kabbalah, that if you want to achieve spiritual awareness, you have to open yourself up to your body awareness. You cannot go to one without the other, because that's the tree. You are the tree. Ki ha'adam etz ha'sodeh. It says in the Torah, for the human being is the tree of the field. the more we root ourselves in earth, the higher we go toward the heavens, toward spirituality. It's lopsided to do one without the other.
And yet there are so many, as we call them, New Age spirituality out there that, you know, that is all about everything above, and they're so not grounded in this earth that...
yes. Oh, yeah, I walk in the light, and the light, and the light, you know. I feel like, you know, turning on a flashlight for these people.
Perpetually.
Yes, perpetually, exactly. You know, the earth, hello. In our ancient scriptures, in our creation story, the Creator speaks to the earth and says, Totzi ha'aretz nefesh chaya, earth, bring forth living soul. See? And then it says, and the Creator breathed the living soul into the nostrils of creation. So soul, our spiritual beingness, emanates from both. It comes from God direct, and it comes from God through the earth, through creation. And if we just let go of creation and try to shuttle to the God world without creation, it's half-assed, as we say in Aramaic.
Oh, I think that's said in a few places, yes.
But I think I
found that one of the most beautiful things that I read about in your book was, you know, how each star, each planet has its own soul.
Yes. Uh-huh. That's a fundamental belief in the Jewish tradition. And that's not even in the Kabbalah. That's from Maimonides, who was a rationalist. You know, the 12th century Rabbi Moshe Ibn Maimon, in his code of Jewish law, in the very beginning, he states that. He said, you should know that everything God created is imbued with divine soul, and that the planets and the stars have a soul just a little lower than the angels, but higher than the human. You know, and that's how we get into Jewish astrology, that the planets, the stars, have influence. They're like the guardians of their little sister, this planet.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the story of Esther in our scriptures, there's a story of this woman named Esther who becomes the queen of Persia. And in her story, it says that she was surrounded by seven handmaidens. So in the Kabbalah, we go beyond the story and we say, let's see, Esther is Hebrew for hidden, for mystery. Seven handmaidens, those are the seven planets that are the handmaidens of Esther, of the mystery planet, which is this planet. And so that's Mars and Jupiter and Saturn and Venus and Mercury and Sun and Moon. You know, these are the handmaidens of the Earth, and they influence us in our birth time and in our lifetime. They have great soul, and they have spirit keepers who imbue us when we are born under their particular influence with particular traits and characteristics and predispositions. You know, it's just beautiful to see how in ancient times we and many other traditions across the world who have never met each other came up with the same kinds of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe the world is much smaller than we believe.
Yeah, I mean, even in bad things like weapons, you know,
yeah.
The Native Americans had bows and arrows, and so did the ancient Hebrews, and so did the ancient Celts. They never met each other, but they somehow came up with bows and arrows. They somehow came up with drums. The Hebrews drummed. The Native Americans drummed. And the Celtics drummed. I'm not talking about the sports team, you know. And everybody seemed to drum, and everybody seemed to have bows and arrows and spears and shields.
Right.
And they never met each other, you know. Mm. So all across, somehow the farther back you go, we were just a little clan, and then we branched off. But we took with us some very elemental concepts that we then seeded and planted in our respective gardens of the earth. and created each our own tree of life. Every tradition, every ancient tradition, every Aboriginal tradition is very, very potent and sacred with this kind of wisdom.
Hmm. Yeah. You talk about, I mean, you mentioned drumming, and, you know, my belief is the drumming has probably been the heartbeat of Gaia or the planet or the earth.
Uh-huh.
But you also talk, you know, of the benefits of chanting and prayer and dance and breath and music.
Right.
I mean, it's all there.
Yes, yeah. All it is important because, you know, drumming in our tradition has to do with the rhythm of life. And timing and story. You know, the Kabbalah teaches that the Creator created the universe in three concentric spheres. The sphere of the laws of the universe, which is like laws of physics, Newton's apple or Newton's fig, much, much more tastier. And then you have within that circle of the laws of nature, you have time, process, unfolding. The laws of nature say, a seed planted in the soil will yield a tomato, and time says not so fast, over a couple of months maybe. And then you have within the time, the central circle of these three is called story. Mm. And they're all spelled the same in ancient Hebrew.
Mm.
You know, they're just the vowels have changed. So you have Sefer, Sipur, Sipur. That's all, just a pronunciation of the vowels change, but the letters remain the same, because it's all one continuous spiral that turns into three, that ripples itself into three spheres. And the drum and chant is about that. So when you're drumming, the rhythm of the drum has to do with the laws of the universe. That's rhythm. You know, it just stays the same. Laws of gravity and so on and so forth. The time and process circle is reflected in the timing of the beating of the drum. And then you have story. Story is the chant.
Nice.
And story is magic. And that's the secret of sorcery and magic. Because story alters the timing of the beating of the drum, which in turn alters the rhythm.
Hmm.
See? So we alter a lot of the laws of the universe in story. So the laws of the universe, for example, is about gravity. You can't negotiate gravity. But in story place, you can.
Hmm.
We created airplanes. You know, the fantasy, the imagination of the human is very powerful. Story is incredibly powerful. And that's why a lot, I would say like 60-70% of our tradition is story, based on story. The Talmud tells us, the ancient rabbis back 2,000 years ago, they state that more beautiful are the stories in the ancient Hebrew scriptures than the laws. More important are the stories than the laws of ritual and practice.
Nice.
Because the story is what we remember, and the story contains within it myriad interpretations and ramifications for every aspect of our life. Each of us, every time we choose to do something in life, to take action in life, are creating a story. And we become the ancestors of future generations through our choices, which are our stories.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the drum is very important, and so is chant, and so is breath. You know, the breath contains within it the three mothers of creation, which enable the earth to be what it is, what she is. The earth cannot be who she is without fire, water, and wind. Without sun, which is fire, rain, which is water, and wind. The earth cannot be who she is. And we have that in our breath. When you blow your breath on the palm of your hand, for example, you will experience moisture, which is water, the mother water. And then you'll feel warmth, which is the mother fire. And you'll feel breath, wind, which is the mother wind. So these three mamas, the Kabbalah talks about, are the three mothers of creation. Shalosha Imaot, they're called. The three mothers of creation. And they're in abbreviation, they're called Amashe. which is one of the very sacred names of the divine in our tradition in the Kabbalah, because they are what keeps everything existing. Without it, we don't live. Without it, the earth is not. And they play, of course, a very important role in chanting. You can't chant without breathing.
Wow.
And we also blow them, in, you know, the wind of them that carries them through the ram's horn or the horn of the antelope that we use in various rituals, not just on a New Year celebration. We use them for healing. We use them at funerals. We use them at life cycle celebrations in the Kabbalah. We blow the breath in a very special, sacred way through the horn of the antelope or the sheep.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Now, is it safe to say then that all stars and all planets would be the feminine aspect then of God?
It would be safe to say that that that's probably very true. You know, I don't know all the planets and stars.
Right.
I know that in the Kabbalistic tradition, there is masculine and feminine in everything that God created.
Right.
And in some things more feminine than others, and some things more masculine than others. For example, the moon is considered feminine. The sun is considered mm-hmm. masculine. And at the same time, the Hebrew word for sun, there are two Hebrew words for sun and two Hebrew words for moon. And one is feminine, one is masculine. You know, so in everything there is both. In every man there is a woman, in every woman there is a man. Some of them, in certain times and seasons of what they do, and how they influence us and what they give to us, become one or the other. So there are times that the moon is feminine, and there are times that the moon is masculine. It depends what she is doing. Is she waxing or waning?
Mm-hmm.
What phase of the moon? Many of our festivals, of our sacred festivals, are done at the full moon. And then there are some that are done at the sliver of the first sliver of the moon. So, you know, there's a dance of masculine and feminine throughout the universe. It's like a tango, you know. People, they take turns being one or the other.
Mm.
And that's what we do in life, too. That's a very important part of dance in relationships. You know, we need to do what the Kabbalah teaches God did at the beginning of creation. God didn't just create, God also stepped back from creation, by virtue of which creation had the opportunity and space to come into being. So there's both the moving into and the receiving. There's the masculine and the feminine. You know, the masculine brings the raw, creates the raw, and the feminine unfolds the raw, directs the raw material into becoming something. It's like Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who lived in the 3rd century, he was visited by an angel who said to him, "Ask me anything and I shall tell you." So he said, "Why women?" So the angel said, "When you shear the wool off your sheep, do you wear it?" "No, I give it to my woman and she makes me a nice sweater." "When you harvest your wheat, do you eat it?" "No, I give it to my woman and she makes me nice bread." "When you harvest your cotton, do you wear it?" "No, I give it to my woman and she makes me nice bed sheets and blankets." And so the angel grabbed him by the throat and said, "Well, don't you get it?" "She stands you on your feet and illuminates your eyes. You, what's the matter with you?" You know? So there's everybody contributes in their particular way, and sometimes the other way around, you know. Sometimes the man makes the bread And the woman brings the raw material. Sometimes the son does it a feminine thing, and sometimes the son does a masculine thing. In the beginning, before creation, the Kabbalah teaches the creator back from itself, within itself, constricted itself to enable there to exist, for there to exist a space void of itself within which creation could then happen. And that's how we have free will. Were God to fill the universe, the Kabbalah teaches, the universe could not exist because there's nothing but God. It's like trying to build a log cabin on the sun. And were God not to fill the universe could not exist because it takes the breath of the Creator and the will of Creator for creation to be, because we're all a figment of God's imagination. If God stops thinking of us, we're not here. And so God so limited itself so that creation could be, and so filled creation so that creation can be. And that's like the paradox of existence. We are here because God wills us to be, and we unfold our lives because God steps back. And by stepping back, creation has the opportunity to unfold in its own way, and that is the gift of free will. In the second century, they asked Rabbi Akiva, here's a perfect example of Jewish philosophy. They asked Rabbi Akiva, is everything predetermined or do we have free will? And his answer was, everything is predetermined and the choice is yours. You know, typical Jewish philosophy.
Yes. I noticed that humor seems to be part of your tree of life as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yoshe b'shamayim yishak, it says in the book of Psalms that King David composed, one of his lyrics, which means the one who sits in the heavens is laughing. You know, I mean, laughter is very important. We have to have play. We have to have a little slack in the rope that we walk in this life. Mm. It's healing, and it also opens up our hearts so that we can receive more of the gift of existence, of being. Many of our ancient teachers, some of our contemporary ones too, would customarily open up their deepest teachings with story and humor in order to open up the hearts and lighten the anxiety of the disciples.
Wow.
The humor is very important.
I think you write somewhere about it being necessary for wisdom.
Yes, exactly. That's right. That's right. Ain't to altele chachmasa balishitusa. That's Aramaic for there's no handle to grasp wisdom other than foolishness. You know, you got to be a little bit of a fool, a little jester, in order to enable wisdom to have a vessel to grow. If we're too stoic and serious, it blocks out the soul of the wisdom that we receive, and we're left with soulless wisdom, which becomes the distinction between Kabbalah and religion.
Without the soul.
Exactly, wow. Without soul. One can easily study Kabbalah without soul, too. I mean, you know, there's no guarantee. There's soulless Kabbalah as well. Kabbalah requires you to be constantly open. So, you know, the error that happens too often, like in our own times as well, is that some people are teaching or studying Kabbalah only from one source, like just the Zohar, for example, when there are so many, many other schools of the Kabbalah that came about earlier or at the same time. And the more that you open yourself up to the various schools, the more you really get a feel for what Kabbalah is. But if you get too caught up in one school of thought alone, then you miss out on the real gestalt, so to speak, of Kabbalah. I have no idea what gestalt means, but I like using it as a word. And that's why in this book, you know, Daily Kabbalah, I chose from many different sources, you know, not just the Zohar, many different sources to give people a really a broad perspective and feel for the richness of mysticism in general and Jewish mysticism in particular, because, you know, I'm Jewish. But it's important for people to know that you know, mysticism in many ancient traditions is just as rich, just as rich. Say ulamad, go out and study, go out and explore. You'll find that it's very rich to sit at the feet of people who carry on these ancient ways and these ancient wisdom. And the true, you know, the more mystical the person is, the more they laugh. I mean, look at the Dalai Lama. He's always smiling and laughing.
Very true.
You know, and open to jesting and joking. And, you know, he's very light because he's a great mystic. And the more mystical you are, the less you take life so seriously. You know, life is a great comic book. You know, you come here, you work like a dog, and then they kick you out with nothing. You can't take your paycheck with you. It's a great cosmic joke. It's like the Midrash tells us. The Midrash is another part of our oral tradition. It says there that it is likened unto a king who told his servants, "I am going away for a few days. Will you please pour water into the barrels in my backyard?" So the king went away, and the servants began to pour water into the barrels, but the barrels had holes in them, and the water kept coming out, and they were not filling. So the servants stopped filling the barrels because they wasn't getting filled. One servant, however, continued pouring water into the barrels with the holes in them, and they said to him, "Idiot, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, the king never said fill the barrels, did he? He just said pour the water into it." Right? And that's, so the Midrash tells us, you know, that's what, you know, life is. It's not like we're here to achieve anything that we can comprehend. We're not, you know, there's no guarantee in life that we will live long enough to achieve and accomplish what we wish to achieve and accomplish. But there's every guarantee in life that we will be given ample opportunities to try. And life is about effort. Life is about the journey. You know, in our Torah, you know, the people know it as the five books of Moses, whatever, begins with the creation and then the story, and then it continues through the Hebrew peoples coming into Egypt, becoming slaves, getting redeemed by Moses and all that, all the great miracles in the desert, and traveling through the desert for 40 years to get to the promised land, back to the land of the ancestors, and we're almost there, and we're standing at the edge of the Jordan, ready to cross over, and it ends. We never cross over. That's in later books. You know, but in the Torah itself, which is our basic guide, our tradition's basic guide, we never get there. We never get there. And traditionally, you know, we read portions of the Torah every weekend in the synagogue in the community. And when that portion is read, and Moses dies, and we're still at the edge of the Jordan, we haven't crossed over, immediately another scroll is taken out, and we begin from Genesis all over again. See? So we're always beginning, we're never really ending. And that's what life is, that's the teaching of the Torah. The teaching of the Torah is basically that the journey is more important than getting there. So you get there, now what? You know? But the effort we put in to getting there is what makes us grow. It's not the achievement that makes us grow and makes us who we are. It's the effort we put in. It's how much we invest within the limitations of the circumstances of our life. So one person can invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in their life, and another person can invest five. But it depends on the circumstances. You know, if the one who does five is working as hard as the one who does 100,000, that's a greater feat. Hmm. We're here to try. We're here to make the effort. Lefum tzara aga, which is Aramaic for in accordance with the intensity of the effort, is the quality of the reward. And that's a very important piece to the great cosmic joke. You know, we think we're supposed to, like, become something really great, but who's to judge what that is? The Talmud tells us a story about Rabbi Huna, who lived in the 2nd century, and one day, his village caught fire. It was a little tiny village, farming village, and all the homes burned down except the homes on his street. So everybody thought, well, it's because of the great master, because of the merit of the great master, Rabbi Huna, our homes did not burn down on his street. But that night, in a collective dream, they were all told that you should know it is not in the merit of Rabbi Huna that your homes did not burn down. It is rather in the merit of a little old lady down the street who kept her ovens warm and full of fresh baked bread so that when poor people would come passing by, she'd be able to give them something to eat right away.
Mm.
See? So it's not about whether you have a PhD or whether you know all the Kabbalah and you studied the entire Talmud or whatever. It's about how much we do within the limitations of our circumstances, not how much we accomplish or achieve in the eyes of the human.
Mm.
Those standards are subject to change, like taxes. But in the eyes of the Creator, Rachmana li babai, which is Aramaic for the compassionate one, seeks the heart.
Oh.
And that's the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tree of life. Oh. Because the tree grows because of the heart of the earth. The heart of the earth makes the tree grow, brings forth the grasses. The heart is love. And love, the earth's love, she loves, and therefore she sweats out with passion, symbolized and manifested through grasses, trees, plants, myriad flavors and colors and aroma, flowers and so on and so forth. This is the passion of the earth. Tiyupta Tiyana in Aramaic, it is the passion of the earth that creates the tree. And the higher the tree and the more the branches and the more the twigs and the plants, it is indication of the greater that the passion of the earth is expressing herself.
Wow.
It's her passion. So when you walk down the street or in the forest and you smell this beautiful aroma and you see the gorgeousness of color and shape, it is the passion of the earth, and she's reaching out to us to incite and ignite and kindle the flames of our own passion.
Hmm.
Passion is very important. Passion is what moves us. Without passion, we sound like this. With passion, we sound like this. Right?
It's her fire.
Yes. It's her fire. And fire is fueled from below and drawn from above, like the tree.
Hmm.
Just like the tree. The tree is her passion. The tree is her fire.
Hmm.
Fueled from below and drawn from above. And so when she shows her passion by moving outside of herself, by growing the tree toward the heavens become aroused and begin to rain down upon her. The skies become aroused by the feminine passion of the earth and then responds by raining down upon her, impregnating her, and giving her more children to grow. See, so it's a whole relationship of sky and earth, of masculine and feminine, that the Kabbalah talks about. And that's how the Kabbalah, see, that's a good example of how the text in Genesis says, and a mist arose from the earth, and then rain fell from the skies. So the Kabbalah goes deeper and says, okay, let's see what's happening here. This is erotic. This is a an erotic description of the passion of the feminine, of the earth, rousing, waking up, awakening the male comatose of the sky. And the sky responds by sending down the rain, which impregnates the earth, and the children come forth in the form of grasses, trees, animals, people. You know, because, you know, the male is kind of comatose. You know, women, a lot of times women ask their man, "Hey, honey, what's on your mind? What are you thinking?" Huh? Oh, nothing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the male response very often, nothing. Even though he spoke more than she did when they dated. Right? But after dating is over, the romance is gone. He has no words left. It's all gone. He spoke everything already. That's why I tell young men who are dating, I say, look, take a tape recorder with you. Because later on, when you're sitting next to him on the couch and he has the remote, he's not going to be speaking to you anymore. But you can hold his hand, put it around your neck, and turn on the tape recorder. Just make believe he's saying these things. Because he feels them, he just doesn't know what to say anymore. He's already used up all his words in the dating season.
Aww.
So it takes the passion of the feminine to rouse the masculine. So the earth rouses the sky, and it rains. We did this in Israel a few years ago. There was a drought, and I was in Israel, and I was teaching this. And so we began to dance and sing and laugh and really get passionate. And the clouds appeared. It rained. Wow. And it was beautiful. Of course, it took a few days.
Right.
But, you know, we were at it. It was like a rain dance.
Nice.
And because you have to bring out the passion of the earth. We grieve a lot for the earth because of how she's been treated, and the cutting of rainforests. You know, there are things to grieve about. But, you know, you don't go to the hospital to visit a sick friend and say to them, "Oh, my God, you look horrible. Oh, how terrible you look." You know, that doesn't cheer them up. It doesn't help them heal. You have to celebrate. You have to come to them with a smile and with lightness. And then they begin to feel a little moved and motivated and encouraged, and the healing begins. And likewise, when, you know, when we grieve too much of what's happening without celebrating, it doesn't help the earth. She wants us to celebrate. She doesn't just want us to protest against the cutting of rainforest. She wants us also to celebrate, to go and jump on the tree stumps after they cut those things down, those poor trees. And she wants to celebrate and dance and laugh and create and bring back the passion and the joy that she feels deep within her, not only the sadness. It's very important. And I've told this to many groups who go out and do a lot of grieving. Grieving has its place,
yes.
But celebration is very important. She needs us to celebrate her.
Wow.
She needs that more than anything right now.
Mm.
So anybody who's listening to this program, man, go out and celebrate, you know, when nobody's looking.
Bring back that passion.
Yes, go out in the backyard and celebrate. Go find a tree stump that they just cut and hop and jump and sweeten it. And you'd be surprised. There'll be a little sap coming out of that stump.
Oh, well, I should have known, but you have been a delight. Oh, it's so much more than I, you know, imagine when I ordered this book. So I look forward to reconnecting with you sometime. I think we could probably continue this for several more because we didn't touch on anywhere near
your list.
Yes, exactly.
Well, sure. Make another time. I'm glad to talk to you, Laurie.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure. Why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of you?
Of me?
Sure.
Well, they can either go on my website, which is walkingstick.org, walkingstick, one word. Or they can email me at Gershon, G-E-R-S-H-O-N, at walkingstick.org.
Great.
That's my email address.
Awesome. Thank you. And again, very, very, very pleasurable. And I think that a lot of people will maybe understand some of the mysticism a little bit more than previously imagined.
Well, that would be a great joy to me.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lori.
Okay.
Thank you, Lori, and may the Schwartz be with you.
I don't know what that means, but I will say yes.
Well, you have to watch Mel Brooks' Space Pop.
Ah, okay, yes. Now
Take
I know what
care.
It means. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.